Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Niger again, our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. As always, thank you to all of our followers here in the United States and internationally. It's a pleasure and extreme enjoyment to be able to do this every week. I really appreciate all the comments and feedback, and I like when you guys email me questions. The Q&A stuff is really fun. Some of the stuff I've talked to you guys, I can answer, you know, in an email or a short phone call. But, again, as the podcast has continued to grow, realizing what a diverse audience we have, as I mentioned, we have people who are professionals in the field. We have, students who are going into the field. We have people who are struggling with a lot of the different topics and disorders that I talk about. And people just curious about mental health, and family members or people in relationships, with individuals with mental health. And, you know, as I repeatedly say, mental health is a very real thing. And it is, I think we've gotten better, at legitimizing it, but I think we have a long way to go to give it the same parity as, medical conditions. So, I wanted to focus on, because I diagnosed a few in the last, the last week or two, we've talked a lot about like bipolarity, and I've alluded to this, but I don't think I ever dedicated a specific episode to a specific type of bipolar that a lot of people don't know about, which is called cyclothymic disorder or cyclothymia. We've talked about bipolar 1, which is the most severe, which the old term was manic depressive. And if you think of, and bipolar 2, which is a tamped down version of bipolar 1, really the differentiating factor at the most basic level between mania and hypomania, mania and bipolar 1, hypomania and bipolar 2, is the symptoms are the same. It's the duration of time. And bipolar 1, you know, we've talked about, and Julie's mentioned, is really, the bipolar disorders are really neurotransmission, and they are chemical imbalances. So cyclothymia, most people, when I've given this diagnosis, have never heard of it, and it's not always a common referral question. Okay, can you check for cyclothymia? It's usually, there's some kind of mood disorder going on. Now that covers a wide array of potential possibilities, from depression to anxiety to the bipolar disorders. Could be schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, schizophreniform disorder. So it's a wide spectrum, but and even some of the depressive specifiers like major depressive disorder with mixed features. But cyclothymia in and of itself is a legitimate disorder, and it's really. It's a disorder of like chronic fluctuating mood disturbances that involve hypomanic symptoms and periods of depressive symptoms that do not meet the full criteria for mania or hypomania. Mania, the symptoms have to persist for at least 7 days. Hypomania, the symptoms have to persist for at least 4 days. In cyclothymic disorder, you know, I think sometimes when people say, well, the person's really moody, now that could be a possible descriptor for you know, the moods go up and down. That's more consistent with something like cyclothymia versus bipolarity. Because in bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, people are actually transitioning and experiencing for a specified period of time a transition into a distinct mood state different from whatever their baseline functioning is. And the baseline for the vast majority of people with bipolar is depression. And patients I've worked with over the years invariably say they love mania. They love hypomania, you know, decreased need for sleep, grandiosity, euphoria, feelings of invincibility. But a lot of times mania in particular gets people into trouble. Bipolar 2, potential is still there, but generally not as severe. But really with cyclothymia, because the bipolar disorders, separate from the depressive disorders, they do not have the second pole. So we can look at major depressive disorder as unipolar depression, and then there's bipolar depression, which is a different type of depression, and it's treated differently. But the hypomanic symptoms are really not sufficient in severity or pervasiveness to meet the full criteria for bipolar 2, and depressive symptoms are not sufficient to meet the 5 out of 9 for a diagnosis of major depressive disorder. So as you can see, it's a tamped down version where a person is experiencing the two poles, but not to the degree and severity of bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. Average age of onset, I mean, children, you know, it's usually kind of manifests around 6 years old. And the bipolar disorders have one of the highest heritability indices. So family history is a really, that's what gathering a really good family history is a really important part of doing diagnostics, because it's very helpful if there's a family history. That doesn't mean someone's going to get it, but I think there's definitely an elevated level of risk. Especially when you consider what I talked about, the diathesis stress model, the intersection between genetics and physiology and environmental stressors. And the way our world is right now, it is very stressful, and we're inundated by technology and by Amazon and by just the demands of life. But you don't diagnose cyclothymic disorder, because if it can be like schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, schizophreniform, delusional disorder, or something else. And it also has to be not attributed to, you know, this is an important thing in a lot of diagnoses, that these mood symptoms are not attributed to an illegal substance or a medication. So if somebody's, you know, abusing, say, cocaine or, you know, crystal meth, I mean, they're going to be in a hyper elevated state that could look like they're manic or hypomanic. But it's very important, again, getting that detailed history. You know, if someone says, yeah, I act that way when I'm using crack, we're using cocaine. Okay, those symptoms, that's a totally different explanation for why that person is acting away. That's a substance use issue. Certain medications could be stimulant medications for ADHD, Adderall, Ritalin, Vyvanse, Concerta. Those are medications that work. There are also medications that are abused. And this is why it's so crucial to get a neuropsychological evaluation, because I can't tell you how many people that I test off for their stimulant medications do not have ADHD. That it's oftentimes, it could be something like cyclothymia. Depression mimics ADHD all the time. Anxiety, panic. So it's so crucial, because they're filling out a form. And I talked about this, and you could go listen to the episodes I did on ADHD. That's why I would never base a diagnosis of ADHD off of just a simple rating scale. Doesn't mean I wouldn't use them, but I would never, ever, ever base a diagnosis of ADHD off of someone's subjective rating. So this is why, you know, getting that history is so important, because if a person says, yeah, well, I'm snorting Adderall or I'm snorting my Concerta, that's, you know, they may look like they're hypomanic, they may look like they're manic, but that's when you say it's attributed to, you know, the physiological effects of a substance. And individuals can do very well, during periods of hypomania. And, you know, but it does, you know, to meet the diagnostic criteria, and this is in all of the different disorders of the DSM, has to cause clinically significant distress and social, emotional, occupational functioning. So somebody may meet the diagnostic criteria and impairs their life, but, you know, helping someone to, you know, therapeutically from a cognitive behavioral perspective is helping somebody recognize when they may be entering into this, whether it's you know, true hypomania or just symptoms of it, if we're just talking about cyclothymia, of maybe learning, you know, what are the warning signs? And I hate the word trigger, but, you know, what are the kind of the, you know, kind of amps up? And what are those warning signs? And finding ways to find constructive behaviors to engage in, as opposed to ones that are much more high risk and have potential for destruction and negative consequences for the individual, or even for, you know, their job or their relationship. Because if you're feeling on top of the world and you have grandiosity and euphoria and invincibility, it doesn't make sense that you're not going to have much regard for, you know, what path or trail of destruction that you're leaving until those symptoms subside. Then you kind of look back and be like, oh boy, that was a problem. So, you know, cyclothymia, it can begin in children and adolescents, but it generally begins in adolescents or early adult, and it can, you know, possibly be a temperamental predisposition to something else. But cyclothymia generally has an insidious onset and a persistent course. And by insidious onset, I'm talking like an immediate onset, as opposed to something that's like gradual. You tend to see that more a lot of times with schizophrenia, has a more of a gradual onset. And then, you know, there is a high risk, really a pretty high risk of somebody that cyclothymia will eventually turn into bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. So it does not, it is by no means a guarantee, but, you know, the data is pretty consistent that with bipolarity, and I'm talking about, you know, going back to just cyclothymia, that there's a pretty good chance, I'd say 50 plus percent, that as a person emerges into adulthood, that it will turn into bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. Now, the question is, does it turn into bipolar 1 or bipolar 2 because they've gone undiagnosed and untreated? You know, not sure. I think that's definitely a possibility. So, you know, back to, you know, things I've always said, the earlier you can get a neuropsych eval and get diagnosed, the earlier you can get on the right psychotropic medication, get into the right therapy. And I think there's a possibility that maybe that risk for the development into bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 is possible, that may be reduced. I don't know, and I haven't seen data to confirm that, but I do think, you know, that if it's beginning with an insidious onset in adolescence, it would definitely make sense, you know, for parents to get their kids in for an evaluation, because we do have tests to able to, you know, can ask all the questions, but we also have tests that are able to give us, you know, concise answers. You know, the tests don't tell us what it is. That's the job of being able to score things and interpret them and piece all the information together. And, you know, you do enough of this, it kind of comes like second nature, but it's really piecing everything together and using, you know, standard and reliable instruments. And, you know, it's, again, not to be like, you know, trying to scare people. It's like, oh my God, my kid's going to turn into have bipolar. And again, listen to the episodes we've done on bipolar. It is by no means a death sentence. People with bipolarity have access to parts of their brain that other people don't. And if you can just channel that into creativity and to, whether that's through artistic stuff or, you know, writing music or, you know, writing a book, getting a lot accomplished, cleaning your, a lot of times people will stay up for nights and then cleaning their houses. So there definitely are adaptive ways to transfer these behaviors. But, you know, with cyclothymia, It again being the one of the least severe, but I also why don't they give specific attention to this? Because most people don't even realize that this is a disorder. And I think this is where, again, my opinion, I think this is where people get into, you're up 1 minute, you're down the next minute. That's where they, you're so moody, you're happy one day, you're sad the next. That's more consistent with cyclothymia. Then it is, that is not, those are not statements that you would find with true bipolar one or bipolar two, because those mood states, especially the depression, generally is a much darker depression than just unipolar major depressive disorder. And people sometimes with mania in particular will try and kickstart mania, and maybe sometimes kickstart hypomania by misusing substances, overusing caffeine, snorting their Adderall or buying Adderall off the street or cocaine. And they're trying to kickstart because dopamine feels good and people love dopamine. And that makes, that's our pleasure neurotransmitter. But, you know, there's a lot of comorbidity with cyclothymia and even with the bipolar disorders, but specifically with cyclothymia, substance use disorders and sleep disorders. And those are pretty common, and they can be in sleep as an area. We've done episodes on that, and that is, I think, in my opinion, that's one of the most under-focused areas of mental health. We refer to it as slight sleep hygiene, and this is, I am being a complete hypocrite here. You know, sleep is supposed to be ritualistic and we look forward to it, and should, you know, all electronic devices should be turned off 90 minutes prior to bedtime. This is do as I say, not as I do. But sleep definitely can wreak havoc on that. You know, if Julie doesn't get a good night's sleep, you know, she's thrown off for the next day. I'm somebody who doesn't require a lot of sleep. I'm up in the morning on the Peloton to work early. I just don't require a lot of sleep. But you know, children with cyclothymic disorder often have comorbid conditions, and there's a high comorbidity with ADHD. And ADHD, especially the hyperactive and the combined type, can look like bipolarity, can look like cyclothymia. The difference is true, just unilateral ADHD does not have the mood component. This cyclothymia, as with the bipolar disorders, have a mood component, the depression and the hypomania and cyclothymia. True ADHD, the kids who are hyperactive can look, you know, like they're running on, you know, they're acting like they're driven by a motor. They're you know, they're running on, you know, fumes, but they have just tons of energy. And you know, sometimes if they're prescribed a medication, and that medication wears off, they can become really grumpy at night, and sometimes they report feeling depressed. So that's really important to figure out, again, why diagnostics is so important, because then you work with the prescriber and give them that information, and they are more than equipped, because that's their specialty, of how to kind of cover that. That's why, how we manage the inattention, and then how do we manage, you know, the mood symptoms that are associated with this. So, you know, another thing that's also important to that is in terms of like what we call like differential diagnoses is this borderline personality. Mood, because mood dysregulation is a big part of borderline personality, and individuals with borderline are often labeled as moody. They have shifts in mood that may suggest cyclothymic disorder, and can you be diagnosed with cyclothymia and borderline personality? Absolutely. As you can with bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. So it does look like that. Again, as I've said repeatedly, this is why diagnostics and getting testing is so important, because you're able to get definitive answers of what it is. And all of these are treated differently. Bipolar 1, bipolar 2, cyclothymic disorder, they're treated differently from, or if it's ADHD, from a pharmacological perspective, from a therapeutic perspective. So it's really important to be able to distinguish what it is, but I just wanted to draw attention to this, because I just realized it's not, people who think it's bipolar and the term is used, unfortunately, in our language. It's like, oh, you're so bipolar, you're acting bipolar, you're acting borderline. And back to, a reason of doing the, one of the reasons of doing the podcast is to legitimize, because these are real conditions. These are real things that are happening. These are real things that people are experiencing. And just because this doesn't sound as severe, it can still cause a lot of distress and impairment. If you're feeling up one day and you're down one day, the next day, that's a roller coaster, and that can be difficult for an individual, and that can be difficult for, maybe if that individual has children, or their spouse or partner, where there's that level of unpredictability. Granted, it's not as severe as bipolar 1, but it still has a severity level. If we have it classified in research as an actual psychiatric condition, then it warrants attention and warrants legitimacy, independent of we're saying, well, you don't really meet the criteria for depression, you don't really meet the criteria for hypomania. That should not discount the impact that those symptoms would have on an individual, and people who are in proximity with them. So, let's see. I think I covered everything. Yes. Anything you want to add in terms of like medication? Say something.
Hi, just overhearing the discussion. There are so many people that don't realize that cyclothymia exists. It's just kind of like Cor said, a lower level form of bipolarity. But does it look like rapid cycling? You're saying the mood switches quickly?
Yeah. Rapid cycling is, by definition, is having at least 4 manic or hypomanic episodes a year.
Oh, okay.
So we just take the term rapid cycling, like how we think, like you're so moody.
Yeah.
You're up one day, down the next. That's more consistent with cyclothymia than the bipolar disorders.
Yeah. I find that my clients who, historically, my clients who have cyclothymia are pretty high functioning. They do really well on medication. Currently, I have a few that are just taking lamotrigine and doing well. Sometimes people will be prescribed lithium. Again, with the depression and the mania, lithium is really the only mood stabilizer technically out there. And it really works really well with bipolar, any form of bipolarity, because it's effective in treating mania. And it's very effective treating the depressive episodes. But cyclothymia is just a more mild form of it. My clients that I'm working with right now are very high functioning people and have responded really well right now to lamotrigine that I'm prescribing. But it's definitely it's really, really possible to have more than one diagnosis. So like we always say, symptoms overlap. If someone's genetically predisposed to bipolarity, that could be triggered by showing up at a provider in a depressive state, not realizing that you've had a manic episode or a hypomanic episode, and being put on presenting as depressed and just being unaware, which I feel like happens very often, that these clients are unaware of and cannot define or maybe pinpoint a hypomanic or a manic state. Then they show up, and when someone shows up and they're depressed, first line of treatment is antidepressants. So antidepressants can cause a suicidal ideation and increased depression, obviously, but at the same time, they can also put someone into a manic state. Typically, those are the SNRIs that can trigger mania, but the SSRIs as well. So it's, I can't emphasize enough. Unfortunately, it's a luxury to get neuropsych testing these days. It's very hard to come by. And I have treated many people who have not had neuropsych evals. You know, right now, this is our philosophy, and this is our, you know, this is our belief system. This is how we treat our clients now, because we're able to at this point in time in our careers. But prior to this, I was given a lot of clients that, you know, sometimes clients just aren't able to, you know, really are not, I don't know, they have trouble with self-report. They have trouble with, you know, the insight, or they don't have the education or the knowledge to recognize when something like a hypomanic episode is there. Like I said before in several episodes, you know, hypomania, I usually, you know, people usually aren't getting in a lot of trouble and they usually enjoy it. And I mostly, you know, kind of, you know, check in with them, you know, about what the behavior is. Is the behavior becoming dangerous or reckless? You know, sometimes someone might dye their hair blue or, you know, get a body piercing or something like that, but it's not like full blown mania. And again, you know, all of these, and a lot of bipolar, I have several bipolar patients who have borderline personality and also ADHD and also PTSD. So, and when you're getting treated for that, ADHD is the last you treat, because the stimulants, if you do decide to use a stimulant or an antidepressant like atomoxetine or bupropion to treat ADHD, but the stimulants tend to aggravate schizophrenia. They aggravate bipolarity if it's not stable. You know, all of the moods, it's so important to, and it's really, like I said, I don't want this to be a luxury. I want everyone to be able to get a neuropsych eval. We need more neuropsychologists that do testing. We need more psychologists that do testing. So anyway, I mean, if you're looking into a field of psychology, I would say that there's a dire need for that. So we talk to a lot of people who want, you know, kind of mentorship, you know, just to check in with, or, you know, just to talk about where they're at and they're in the field of psychology and what direction do they want to go in? Do they want to prescribe medication? Do they want to just do therapy? But, and, you know, we need therapists, we need prescribers. But I think more than anything else, we need doctors who do neuropsych testing. That is an absolute shortage. And I believe that that's everywhere. And I think in there's certain parts of this country and the world where it doesn't exist. So, you know, that's why we do this podcast, so we can talk to you. That's why we give out the phone number so that we can talk with you and, help in any way that we can. We can't treat you. This is not a treatment modality here, but this is just for psychoeducation, and support, and to help people, you know, to give people hope. And we just don't want people to feel alone. And mental health issues can make people feel very alone. So it's, thank you for reaching out. For those of you who do, for those of you who are too nervous to, don't. Please reach out to us. We're pretty good about getting back to people. If you have questions, ask away. I'm happy to talk about anything that, you know, someone wants to talk about related to any of this matter. And you wanted to add something about bipolarity?
I would just say one of the things that's really helpful is when you have collateral information, mm-hmm. A spouse, a parent, to kind yeah. of, especially with cyclothymia, to kind of just like, what are you seeing?
Right.
You know, from somebody else's perspective.
I agree. But, you know, on the flip side, I always ask my clients whenever they start any medication, who do you trust? Who are you very close with? Who is a non-critical person in your life? Meaning, not that they're never critical, but in a lot of families, I find that several of my clients over the years have been the identified patient. So they've been the ones who have issues, and the other family members are like, you know, take your meds, or it's not necessarily good feedback that they get. It's more just like, you know, talk to your prescriber. You need more medication. Because, you know, maybe they get upset over something, you know, and then ultimately, it's not a good dynamic at all. In fact, that's, I think, part of the problem with the stigma of mental health is that sometimes people at home don't have the support, or the parents just, you know, family members, you know, look at back generations back in, you know, the United States, people weren't aware, you know, the general popularity were not aware. I mean, people didn't carry, you know, formal diagnoses unless they went into hospitals. And so psychiatry, psychology, it's come a long way. But I do agree with Core that we have a long way to go. And I think that's really all I wanted to say.
All right.
Okay, God bless you, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for popping in. So hopefully this was helpful. Like I said, it's a topic, and even Julie agrees that many people don't even know this exists. But I do think that terminology of you're moody, you're cranky, you're up, you're down, kind of fits cyclothymia. I'll reiterate what I said and what Julie said. Yes, it would be great. I mean, this is how we, my philosophy and Julie's, you get, neuropsych testing is really the way to be able to parse out what it is and what it's not. And it's something that I am happy to have dedicated and devoted my life to. Yes, I work a lot, but I never feel like I'm working, and I'm blessed and I'm grateful for that. And I love what I do, and I do what I love. And, hopefully that passion comes across. So I appreciate all of the guys who follow us, and, you can reach me through Psychology Today. You can, email me directly at psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. You could follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_. And you can even contact me directly at 617-750-9411 East Coast Standard Time in the United States.
And lastly, and I know where I repeat myself, and I'm not going to speak much about it, but the Wild Horse and the SAFE Act, which is very important that gets passed with Congress. I am posting everything on our stories. So, and I do even have, we have actual posts that say, here's how you contact the President Biden. Here's how you contact your local. It's easy peasy, takes 5 seconds, but signing a petition for the safety and welfare of our wild horses, which populations are diminishing, and also for the proper treatment of animals, that they be treated humanely. When, you know, I'll just look at the podcast. I don't want to go on and on.
Look at the podcast.
I mean, look at the Instagram, please, if you get a moment. It's not the greatest page. I know, it's not our strong suit. We're busy. It's not our skill set, but I do post stories there very, very often in ways that you can help. And I'm not asking you to donate money. I'm just asking you to please look into this and see who I'm posting and follow them on Instagram, or at least look at what their information is, because they give very easy click of the button, sign a petition, you're done. And we already have 22,000 people who have signed this petition. There are two different ones. There's the Horse and Burro Act, and then there's also the SAFE Act. The SAFE Act is specifically that animals like horses, wild horses, or burros cannot be sold for slaughter. They cannot be sold and out of the country and sent out of the country for slaughter. I know it sounds crazy, but this keeps me up at night sometimes. And I appreciate your help. So would the other people. So would the other advocates. So thank you very much for listening.
Yes, I can vouch for that. It does plague Julie and her dreams. So any support you guys could give, that will be much appreciated. And again, a heartfelt thank you to all of you guys who follow our podcast and the opportunities I've had to meet so many people and talk to so many people from all over the world. It's been one of the coolest experiences, and I'm forever grateful for that. And I will talk to you guys next week. All right, take care. Bye, guys.